And I'll ask you now to turn to page 434 in the Gray Hymnal. 434. It's fine to remain seated. And if you would read along with me, that would be great. May we be reminded here of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. And if you would just take a moment to settle yourselves in, if it helps to understand that you are a vessel, and you get to have a sense of how much light, how much fuel is in that vessel. And then you can just allow that vessel of you to receive. Just receive. And if you have energy and love to give, to extend your heart, to extend your intention out to those around you, in this room, to those you love who are not here. Beyond them, to those we don't yet know. And even further, to those we have pushed away from our hearts because we don't agree, because we're angry, because we're hurt, because we need to be separate to be safe. From this place of love and safety and acceptance, we send our love and our hope for healing out into the greater world. And we ground ourselves here to all that we know to be good and loving and whole. May it be so for us all. And again, with the hymn, I'm going to invite you to remain seated because Spirit of Life is very much a prayer that was written by Carolyn McDade when she was feeling empty. She describes herself as having felt like really dried up cardboard that, you know, you'd pick it up and it would just fall apart, flaking on the floor. It was that dried up. So 123 is Spirit of Life. And those of you who know it, well, just sing along. If you'd like to just listen to it to help you fill up that cup, please do. I'll invite you to sing it twice, and then after we sing it with the guitars twice, Jim and Pam, I'm wondering if after our second time of singing it through with the guitars, we can just hum it together a cappella.
Spirit of life, come unto me. Stirrings of compassion, blow in the wind, rise.
So we collect offering for two different occasions this morning. One is to support the vision of this community to create a container for those of us who are not at all alike. Those of us, we call ourselves seekers and journeyers, and we do not have to agree for ourselves, but also for a future that will have a Unitarian Universalist tradition for the next generation and the next. So that is what we take our first collection for. And the second, which will have kitchen towels in the basket, is for the food pantry.
Four strong winds that blow lonely, seven seas that run high, all those things that don't change, come what may. The hard good times are all gone, and I'm bound for moving on. I'll look for you if I'm ever back this way. I think I'll go out to Alberta. The weather's good there in the fall. I've got some friends that I can go to work in for. Still, I wish you'd change your mind if I'd ask you one more time. But we've been through that 100 times or more. Four strong winds that blow lonely, seven seas that run high, all those things that don't change, come what may. But our good times are all gone, and I'm bound for moving on. I'll look for you if I ever back this way. If I get there before the snow flies, and if things are going good, you could meet me if I sent you down the fair. But by then it would be winter, there ain't too much for you to do, and those winds sure can blow cold way out there. Four strong winds that blow lonely, seven seas that run high,
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Well, I'm going back and forth in my head, and since I opened my mouth starting this way, I guess I made a decision. I'm going to tell you a very brief story that has been an extraordinary context for preparing for this service, which is that 11 years ago, my relationship of 15 years ended in a very, very, very difficult way. And it was a decision that I made to not have contact in order for me to heal and to be whole. And probably 5 years ago, I started wondering, is it time? Should I reach out? And I kept saying, no, I'm whole, I'm good, I'm happy, don't go there. And so on my way back from a workshop that I had in Boston, just on Thursday, we're talking 3 days ago, 4 days ago, I was driving back from Boston, parked my car at a rest area, went in, got something to drink, came back out, sat in the car, looked over, and there was my ex-partner of 11 years ago. 11 years. And the first thought that both of us had was, what an extraordinary universe. Who could explain this? Who could explain that at the point where we were both ready to forgive and to bless one another, and to continue just being, living separate lives, but to be in such a whole place, to be able to just say thank you and move on, was extraordinary, because I'm still not done writing my service on broken relationship, right? So, you know, the universe is extraordinary. That's right. It's a small world, but it's actually quite extraordinary world. And these are the days of awe that begin tonight. Rosh Hashanah. They're also followed by the days of atonement, the days of recovenanting. And so what struck me as I was approaching this holiday was thinking, now, how does a community like ours that values covenant, dwelling together in peace, seeking truth in love, how do we hold that when there's conflict, when we must leave one another, when there is a brokenness? How do we hold ourselves in covenant and love and compassion when we must, or we don't have a choice, right? So what I also went back to Jonathan Haidt, who was a person, a social psychologist researcher, Harvard person who is world-renowned, talk about the necessity of polar opposites, the necessity you've got to have conservative, you've got to have liberal in our universe, in our world, in our country. You've got to have that in balance if you can work over and over and over again for that balance. And he talked about the Grand Canyon as being this spectacular, awe-inspiring place. But he said the more inspiring thing is that people in a group learned how to live in that setting. And people in a group learned how to live on the ice cap, or not the ice cap, but way up in the Arctic, that people have learned how to live together on a desert. And he talked about that in part as using all of our tools as human beings, that one of the primary ones was religion, was a way of helping us as humans identify what we wanted to strive for as community and how to be together in community. And that evolutionary handle, that evolutionary skill, enabled us to be in human community, in places like deserts and places where it's so, so, so cold. So given all these things, I started looking at my training in religious community and my spiritual development and the words that live in me And I want to know what words live in you as well that have to do with relationship, being in covenant. Words like atonement, reconciliation, words like forgiveness, mercy. What are the words? What are the words that you, that are either imprinted on or that were offered to you and you're like, but what are the words about covenantal relationship that are alive in you or that you see others that help bring them together in community? There's covenant. There's abiding. Accepting. Empathy. Trust, forgiveness,
compassion,
willingness, yes, altruism. What other, yes?
I asked my therapist if he was doing a fast for Yom Kippur. He said he didn't believe in atonement.
Thank you, I think. Atonement, asking for forgiveness for what we've done, reconciling. That is the work of Rosh Hashanah. It's going to those I have slighted or hurt or betrayed and trying to make amends for the sake of human community and for the sake of being in alignment with what I claim to be the most true, most sacred. We may name that in really different ways. We do. I know we do. Some of us claim and know and experience a God. Some of us claim and feel, experience a goddess, a universal impulse, a natural world that is just so compelling that we have to belong. We're part of something so much greater than ourselves. However you name that, for you and me, for us to be in alignment with that, it takes some work. I think there's so much wisdom in the Jewish tradition to help human communities keep doing the work, keep doing the work, keep doing the work. So our affirmation is another one of them. It's a covenant, right? It's a vision. It's a hoped-for way of being together. And it is very important, but I have to say what's even more important is what we do when we break covenant with one another. What do we do when we break covenant with one another? What happens when this relationship that we believe in, that we want to build, either breaks or it doesn't feel real? What's our commitment to it? And wow, I have to tell you that there's, I know in me it's real. I know in me that I have goals and images and feelings that I really care about, and I fail them on a regular basis. And it is painful. It's disappointing. And I saw those feelings flash across some eyes in this room. So I think some of the work that we have is to figure out how to be in our covenant when we break our covenant, not if, when. We're human beings. We come here not because we're perfect and we all know how to live. We come here in part because we need something and we have something to give, but also because we don't know how to live what our beliefs are in community. It's a lot easier for me to live my beliefs when I'm by myself, but to live it in community is a whole heck of a lot harder. And we fail, and we fail, and we come back. We try to learn. We fail. That is what community is about, and that's what religious and spiritual community is about. So 1985, I had to do a lot of work on trying to figure out the paradox of holding a vision and something you so deeply believe in and a reality that just is such a contradiction. So I started working. I had begun a program called the Nonviolence Project. So I was doing a lot of teaching. I was in prisons. I was in a lot of different places in community settings talking about the practice of nonviolence. And I was doing that from learning from Mahatma Gandhi and from there are a couple of institutes of nonviolence. So I was really steeped in this work. And then I decided that I needed to try to live the work in a different way. So I started working in the field of domestic violence. Wow. To move in the world knowing that I have these values, which we share, and then to, on a daily basis, moment by moment, be exposed to the utter worst of what people can do to one another. And to figure out how to reconcile that was really hard work. So what I did first was to resist the common notion that people who were violent or used domination as a way to be in relationship were actually not always bad people. And in fact, it was a learned behavior. In fact, there were choices that were made by that person so they could choose to not dominate. That, in fact, totally rejecting that individual and vilifying that individual made it almost impossible for that individual to reconcile and to figure out how to act differently. So I was learning all these things, and in fact, I actually did lose my job because then I shifted from moving in a shelter to doing training with police officers and healthcare providers, and I started talking about how domestic violence is not about bad men and victimized women, but it's about things that we've learned and what we've taught men and women about emotional dynamics, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot. I could do that in another service. But I got fired because I broke the story that battering was about bad people and victims. So in our faith tradition, we're challenged to figure out how to live our vision when we are in, to say it's an imperfect world is like a ridiculous statement. We're having to face choices every single day about how we might live with this vision that we have. So it was another job that I had after I became a minister. I became a staff person for our Unitarian Universalist denomination. And I worked with congregations all over the Northeast and then in the country because I was the only specialist for small congregations. And what we learned very quickly is we had to teach congregations about conflict, about brokenness, because the desire was to keep everybody in and to bury the problem. And unfortunately, that meant the problems escalated and became very dangerous in a number of situations. So I was needing to learn myself and then teach about conflict. And so one of the things I want to show you, because this is not a workshop, but for the sake of having our conversation here, there is Speed Leaves is a, this says solution on it. Speed Leaves is a researcher and consultant through the Alban Institute that's been working for many, many decades with congregations. So he has been teaching, and I learned from him, that there are essentially, there are stages of conflict, and where you have a problem and you can work out a solution, that it, like, if two people are involved, solutions, you're solution-based, right? You're working with a couple people, you build a solution. And then you get into a situation where there's real disagreement. And that disagreement, if you've got two people, two groups, it's still at this level where you understand that it is normal in life to have disagreements. It is so normal. And in fact, it's an opportunity. Don't you hate that when somebody says, you know, you're in the middle of pain, or anger, and somebody says, great opportunity to learn. So disagreement is normal, great opportunity to learn. And then we go to, if it's not dealt with, it escalates into a contest where you get winners and losers. So much of what we learn from a young age is here about winning and losing. So when you've got a conflict in a church or anywhere else, the goal is to shift this conflict from winning to losing to figure out how to problem solve so that more of the people, hopefully all the people, can benefit from the solution, right? So you go, if it's still not resolved, my wall's going to fall down. It escalates to a place where people are not thinking anymore. They're just reacting to each other. And it's fight or flight. You've heard that one before, right? Fight or flight.
Or freeze.
Right, right. Not a lot of constructive work happening there. And then it escalates even more to this level where not only am I fighting or flighting, fleeing, I am, my goal is to kick you out. My goal is that you will no longer, I won't have to deal with you anymore. These layers, the less thinking and the more instinct and the punishing one another and kicking each other out, those are very difficult conflicts to resolve. They almost always require somebody from the outside because nobody's thinking anymore on the inside. So think about some of the things that are happening in our culture today. And you realize so much of what's happening around racism, around poverty, where there's violence, where there's domestic violence, it's really hard to get to a place where you can actually create solutions. So you become very committed, as I am, to making sure that there's safety. Oh, and there's one other thing. So in situations where the problem is not acknowledged or goes underground, you don't have an opportunity to work or grow in this situation. And so often I found myself in small congregations encouraging a conflict to surface so we could actually grow from it. I'm going to not use the mic anymore, but we'll get new batteries. So we have expectations because we're a faith community. We have desires. We have faith. We have a real commitment, many of us, such a commitment to build who we can be. And we can only do those things if we actually know something about working with our conflicts. So once you know where the conflict is, what level we're at, we can actually do a little bit more growing and learning. And the phrase that I picked up on is, please don't waste this conflict. Please don't waste this conflict. If there's a conflict here, if there's a tension, or if there's a conflict in my relationship, I think one of the things that happened in my early relationship was that we didn't use the conflict. We didn't benefit from the conflict. Growing was not possible if one didn't benefit and really pay attention to the conflict. So what might a spiritual intervention or a religious intervention or a Unitarian Universalist intervention in situations look like? And that's part of where I'm hoping our conversation will land today. Who are you as a person who values this affirmation? And when you're out in the world or when you're in your friendships, in your the circles of your influence, how do you live that belief, these visions that we have? How do you use those out in the larger community where it is so much harder. So one of the things that I'll leave you with is a sense that here is also a place where we can share with each other and learn strategies for helping ourselves grow, helping our larger community grow, helping our culture mature, so that we are more and more likely to be in conflict and benefit from being in conflict. Using our covenant, living in our covenant, falling from it and coming back to it, working with our love in a way that has muscle. It's not a passive love. It's a love that has muscle. So I'm just going to invite you to think about places where there may be in your life that you see or wonder where there's a conflict that is being hidden, submerged, and where we might actually benefit by surfacing it. Where in your life that you are learning something about needing to take care of yourself as part of a covenantal way of being in relationship is not being in relationship, is choosing to not be in the relationship. Not out of, you know, I just thought of the samurais, the Japanese warriors, who make their choices to do what they do, not out of a sense of anger or hate, but out of a sense of clarity and conviction to their own beliefs, to their covenant. So it might be that a covenantal way to be would be to limit connection. Depends on the intention. So I would like to, there's so much more that I've written here that I'm not going to share because I think we might be ready to have a conversation. And so I would like to invite you to look at hymn number 6. This is a hymn that comes from my first mentor. He had a congregation that went from, there were 10 people, and when he died, there were 900. He was quite charismatic. And Bob didn't understand conflict. And so when he died, there were 900 people, and we didn't know how to deal with our conflicts with one another. And this is the song we chose to sing in his honor, hymn number 6.
Thank you.
Thank you, and please be seated.